Hello, welcome back to Taboo. My name's Katrina. I'm joined by Ellie Coleman and Blaine Perriton. Would you guys like to introduce yourself, Ellie?
Sure. Ellie Coleman, Chief Investment Officer and Head of Development Finance at Tab.
Blaine?
Blaine Perriton, Founder and Managing Director of Pride IMS, which is a 100% specialist monitoring surveying practice.
Great. Well, as you would have guessed by our special guest, Blaine, we are going to be talking about monitoring surveyor and everything that comes with it. And we'll start with question number one, which is quite simply, what is a monitoring surveyor?
It depends who you ask, I think, is the answer you'll get to this. I think if you ask borrowers, it's a necessary evil. Funders, I think, would define us as we're a risk protection mechanism for them. So I look at the RSS has a definition which calls us independent lenders monitors. And what that means is we are the eyes and ears of the bank or the lender, and we are there in terms of a risk capacity to review a development, check there's nothing that could cause a problem or potentially be a foreseeable risk to the lender who is putting lots of money to fund a development.
So when do you get involved and what does the work entail once a funder has employed your services?
So we normally get involved in, it's a two-part process for us. So the first part is called the initial appraisal, so that the lender has spoken to a borrower, has received some form of terms and some information, in some cases, SODL information, and that's the bit that we then have to try and access for the bank. So the initial appraisal is us basically setting the story in the scene for the bank to say, in principle, does this development stack? And in that, we look at costs, we look at program, we look at statutory consents, surveys, so anything that may possibly be a risk on the development, and we review that and then put forward our assessment to the bank to say, yes, tick in the box, we're good to go, you're able to lend money on this deal at this moment in time. Then stage two, this is where, again, developers, we are a long-standing problem for them because we are in bed on that deal until completion. So we don't just go away at initial report stage, we stay on the scheme. And then normally on, we will then be involved in the scheme on behalf of the bank, and we are the eyes and ears of the lender. So we will go once a month or a period as defined by the bank and the lender, and we will go and review the progress, review what's going on site, cost program again, statutory consents. And again, we are very much the eyes and ears of the bank throughout the whole project.
Would a borrower have its own monitoring surveyor if it, let's say, you know, you're going to be there no matter what on the lender, mm-hmm. and the borrower was like, hang on a second, I don't agree or whatever, yep. would they maybe be able to hire their own monitoring surveyor to work on their behalf? And how does...
Yeah, they certainly couldn't appoint us. So that would be a huge conflict of interest. So we are acting specifically for the lender and the bank. And they can appoint a monitor, but my argument would be they shouldn't really need a monitor because it's their development. They normally have their professional team, which would comprise a quantity surveyor, a project manager, a site manager. So we're not undertaking them roles. Mm-hmm. We do not act, and we are one, the only firm in the UK, we don't act for developers or borrowers because there is a conflict of interest. We solely act for lenders. But yeah, in terms of a developer, normally they have either an in-house capability where they'll have their commercial team, mm-hmm. their programs team, or they can appoint a surveying practice who would be acting on behalf of the developer in a QS or project management role.
Yes, so that makes sense. So on behalf, you know, for the benefit of our viewers, what's the difference between a monitoring surveyor mm-hmm. who works for the bank and a QS who is part of the developer-led team?
Yeah, so we all... To much to my upset, we often get referred to as a bank QS. And as I detailed earlier on, actually our remit is a lot more all-encompassing than that. So we don't just look at the QS. So actually, the probably easier way is, what does a QS do? And then I'll tell you what the monitor. So a QS is purely looking at costs, procurement, and budgetary measures for a project.
For listeners, what does QS stand for?
Let's Quantity see. Surveyor.
There we go.
Should have said that.
Or bean counter, as we're often referred to. I am by trade a chartered quantity surveyor. So I started my career as a QS, acting for developers. And then I moved the other side of the fence to then act for banks. But yeah, so a QS is more the developer side. It is purely focusing on cost, budgets and procurement. Whereas as a monitor, we don't solely just look at cost. We are looking at program. We're looking at any statutory issues where a bank, for an example, a bank may lend on a scheme that is building 4 units. We need to make sure they are, in fact, building 4 units and it is in compliance with planning and statutory consent. So we look at everything on the development. So we're a risk management function. Mm-hmm. We're not just cost. So we don't just only look at costs.
Cool. And I guess moving on to question number two, does the monitoring surveyor only look at property developments, or I guess do you look at residential,
commercial, you know, mm-hmm. as lenders,
yep.
we employ our valuers to look at properties for valuation purposes. But often there could be the exit may be a development finance. So mm-hmm. do you get involved in other stages with lenders such as TAB rather than just the monitoring surveyor services, which mm-hmm. you said was a risk function
yep.
for that development? But surely there's other functions that you could be useful for.
Yes.
For lenders.
So, and I don't want to talk ourselves into a recession because we all know what current state of the economy and whatnot. But the other capacity that a monitor can provide is in a more distressed scenario where there might be a potential for if the lender is looking to step in or build out the asset or the development, we could also support the bank on that function. But as I say, we would never be supporting the developer. It would always be on behalf of the bank because it keeps our independence. So yes, that is the other role we would do. And in answer to your original question of types, I think you were talking about like residential,
yeah.
industrial. Yes, monitors, surveyors can get involved in all of them, and certainly Pride IMS, we are actively engaged in industrial, residential, commercial, hotels, Bernard Matthew chicken factories, you name it, we can monitor it.
And how often do you go down to site? You sort of mentioned once.
Yeah, this is very much dependent. I have a view, and I'll tell you my personal view and my professional view. We are very much what our instruction is. So if the lender says we require you go to site once a month, or in some cases bi-monthly, or whatever it might be, we will undertake that role. Typically, it's once a month. My professional view and my personal view is I think you can't really leave it longer than 6 weeks, in my opinion, mm-hmm. before going to site. And that's not necessarily just for a drawdown, because where sometimes we get pushback from developers is they might not need the cash to do it. So they'll say, well, we don't need to call you out because we don't need a drawdown mm-hmm. this month. And this goes back to my original point that we're not just a cost function to the bank. A lot can go wrong in an 8 week period on a scheme, and I've seen it where you know they're building incorrectly.
Absolutely. And TAB are relationship driven. We want mm-hmm. to work with our borrowers,
yeah.
and in this scenario, that is developers. And we, I often get asked, well, how often, when you're producing your model of what we're funding and the mm-hmm. finance that comes with that, I'm often asked, well, why do I think, why is it you've put in for 15 occasions that the monitoring sphere is going to come to site? So I said, look, ultimately, it can be as often as you, the borrower, mm-hmm. want. So if you need the cash flow, you can bring me every 2 weeks and say, look, I want Blaine to come to site every 2 or 3 weeks, and that's absolutely fine. But I absolutely agree with what you're saying. There's a limit to how infrequently they can go.
Yes.
And beyond 6 weeks, things can happen on site that you don't want to be blindsided on later,
absolutely,
where they've covered up something that they didn't want Blaine to see, and now it's been avoided. And then what that does is that just takes you up the risk curve of mm-hmm. how the development's progressing and proceeding. So we always say about 4 to 6 weeks.
And I think that's completely
But if they want
right.
3 weeks, then that's absolutely fine, because we understand that borrowers can often spend a lot of money in the early stages of the project.
Yep.
They need that cash flow, and that's absolutely fine for them to call us and subsequently you back to site.
Yes.
I was going to just say, are there any moments in a project that might need more attention than another? So like, let's say it's the beginning where foundations are going in, does that need more than the final stages where the paintings go?
I would say the answer to that again is kind of what we alluded to earlier. Normally it's down to developers' cash flow, and as Eli rightly pointed out, we're seen as a necessary evil which they have to pay for. So every time we put a foot on that site, there is a cost to the developer for us to do that. It's written into the facilities
normally, but
there is still a cost, and that's how they look at it. It's 15 visits, that's what I'm paying for. So from my perspective, I think it is interesting in terms of how often we need to go, because most developers, once a month. But then if they need the cash flow, then it could be 2 weekly or mm-hmm. whenever it's needed, or it can be longer. But in terms of stage of a project, at the initial stage, normally it tends to be things like professional fees. So they might have already engaged and put a lot of professional design work done. So that is what I would define as a soft cost draw. So it actually doesn't necessarily need us to attend the site, because they haven't actually engaged any works. There's nothing for us to see. It's an open field. So you can get around those scenarios by doing things like soft desktop drawdowns to enable them to, which is basically just them providing invoices saying with architects, structural engineers, we've expended all these costs. If it is more physical activity on site, I would say sometimes it's the latter part of the schemes when they're putting in high cost items, so kitchens, toilets, sanitary ware, where there's a lot of bulk cost. The start of projects, yeah, your foundations, but again, I think that tends to be profiled. They don't tend to form all foundations at once. It's normally phased and staged up, and I think the monthly periods work pretty well on that.
You made reference earlier to sort of time on site. I know it's sort of tail wags the dog here.
Yes.
But how often do you need on a site, and when you do go to visit site, do you go? Do you prefer to go, or specifically not, with the developer and the funder as well?
Yeah. So in terms of time on site, the caveat answer is very much dependent on the site and how much is needed, size of the site, type of the site, what they're building. But I would say typically it ranges from probably an hour to an hour and a half on site. And to break that down in terms of what that comprises, it's turning up to the site. Sometimes there might be a site meeting, which is chaired by the site team. So we sit in the progress meeting, which can be half an hour to 45 minutes, sometimes an hour, sometimes 3 hours if it's a large project. And then it's a site inspection. So we'll then walk around the site, we'll take photographs. Then again, it's a catching up with the site team. So possibly reviewing building control, if they've last attended site, is there a report that we can see? So yeah, I would say typically it's an hour to hour and a half is a site inspection. And Eli, in terms of your question of what's my, it is down to the lender and what their preference is. My view, in terms of for me to make my role, to get the most out of my role, if the funder turns up with the borrower and myself, we're battling egos here, and they don't want me to tell them off in front of the funder, which is notably what I would tend to do often on site. So when I review their application, and I completely understand this, their point of view is they don't want to be embarrassed by the monitoring surveyor in front of the funder, because we're managing egos here. Back to what you were saying, it's relationship driven. So I don't think as the funder you get the best experience, because what happens is the borrower is already in a defensive position by the very nature that the funder's there, the monitor's there. So what I have always recommended, if the funder does wish to come down, is let the monitoring surveyor go down earlier, perhaps an hour and a half before. You can come later once we've done the application, we've reviewed the numbers, checked things on site. Because as I say, it's that managing the egos, managing the relationship. And I've never seen it successfully done where it's us walking around with the lender and the borrower, and we're saying, well, you've claimed for windows, I see no windows. That's kind of, that embarrassment factor.
Absolutely. The lender's always looking for the utmost scrutiny.
Yes.
And the developer's looking for the most relaxed life.
Yes.
And you have to sort of marry the two together and manage expectations on that.
It's one of them. We're paid to go in and go for jugular and make sure, so enable us to do that. We are independent as well, and I do repeat that. It's if there's things that the lender's also not doing correctly, we also have to notify that. So we are an independent party, but obviously we are there to protect the bank. And I just think in terms of that independent capacity, if we're walking around there as your kind of attack dog, it just doesn't look, the borrower gets defensive, and I've never seen it work successfully.
Yeah.
And I guess when you've been down to site, you mentioned a chicken farm. Is that one of the most exciting sites you've been on, or what kind of ones are what's your bread and butter, and then what is the most exciting? And
so the bread and butter for us is we are dictated by the lenders, what the appetite of our lenders who we work for, and typically I would say 85% of our portfolio is residential, because that tends to be the market, and then the rest comprises things like hotels, industrial, so it is very much the appetite of the lenders, but our predominant book is 85% residential, which is probably commonplace.
And what's the most exciting site you've ever been on?
The most exciting site, and it actually wasn't in a monitoring capacity, but the most exciting site was the London 2012 Olympics, is an incredible project.
Wow, but that took a long time to walk around.
It did, yeah. So that was, valuations on that site were incredible, to be fair. And the scariest thing was it was all public money that was being expended on these drawdowns. But that was, for me, I still go to that site now, and it still holds a very special place for me.
Yeah.
Knowing that I, at the time, I was a very minor role. I can't say that I built the whole site, but even that little part that I played, and it was on the aquatic centre, was brilliant.
See it being built, and
fantastic.
First eyes on what. Oh, that's really cool.
But I think the thing with that project, in construction terms, there's called the Unholy Trinity, which is cost, program, and time. So time was the key factor on the Olympics. Mm-hmm. It had to be done by 2012. And in that, when you focus on one priority, the rest, other parts of the pyramid start to lose, which is cost. And quality and time were actually spot on, but the cost, as a QS on that site, the numbers were extortionate. Yeah. It was unbelievable.
Was that also the most complicated site you've ever been on?
I wouldn't say actually it was the most complicated. It at the start of the site, for those who may remember what Stratford looked like, it was unexploded bombs and it was marshland. So the actual enabling works on that site was incredible. And I was involved on the enabling works. So I was there from very, very early doors. So that was really complex. But in terms of actually a scheme I am actually monitoring at the moment and they're just about to complete, is the Redlands High School in Bristol, which is being delivered by Juniper Homes. Now, that scheme has, I would say, arguably every type of build that you could imagine on a site. It's got part new build, it's got listed, it's got permitted development, it has refurbishment, it has new build, and it's a fantastic site. And I can only kind of implore people, if you are, they have a website located for it, and it's an incredible achievement what they've done, especially on the fact that they've delivered it during COVID, during all the different political kind of dramas we've had, and they've managed to deliver it, and the product's fantastic, but really complex in terms of how that is managed and how, from a cost perspective, doing the initial appraisal, reviewing different cost benchmarks on all different types of projects, but they've managed to deliver a really good project, and highly complex, that one.
Well, I'll look at that one.
Yeah. As will I.
If we move on to question number three, what kind of tools does a monitoring surveyor use?
Very typical. I'm quite old school in terms of, for me, technology always seems to fail you. So I'm still very much a notepad and pen type of surveyor. I know other people walk around with their iPads and the technology. Just for me, I have all these technology things, but they always tend to run out of battery as soon as I turn up the site. So really the most critical things for myself, and I would say for most monitor surveyors, is your phone in terms of taking photographs of the site. I know that back in the day it was a separate digital camera that we used to carry around, but now phones are so good in terms of quality of photos, they're probably better actually than some digital cameras. And notepad and pen in terms of walking around, marking up. I actually take a floor plan with me every time I go around, so a site plan, and I can go around and actually mark up on that. But pen and paper is by far the most critical implement, I think, for a surveyor.
And how are you presenting your findings? I mean, presumably it's not a scan copy of your notes.
No, it's
forgive
not.
Me if it is. And I
wish it was. It'd make it a lot quicker. No, it's so we, following site inspection and going around reviewing, then we produce a report that goes, that is issued and published to the bank and the lender only, not to the borrower. So that report is, again, it's kind of defined loosely by the bank in terms of what they want to see and what they want us to cover off. And then we kind of fill that in terms of, what's the state of the cost? What's the state of the program? Status on site, quality. Now, whilst we're not necessarily qualified in terms of quality, if we go and see a brick wall and it's wibbly wobbly, it's something we should
you
be flagging.
You can take a judgment on
yeah,
that,
we will
right.
take a judgment and say, you know, we deem there could be some quality issues on this site. Health and safety issues, something as well that, you know, us as monitors and lenders are also liable for, which I think a lot of lenders forget under new health and safety and CDM regulations, the lender is responsible for a scheme that they are lending on if there's health and safety issues. So we should be flagging that as well. And that report is published to the bank. They review it, come back with any queries potentially, hopefully there's none, and release their drawdowns based off our recommendations.
On a very high level, how do you present to the lender, or how do you point out to them some of the key points that are of risk? So whether it be time, cost, health and safety, is there a method within the report that gives them those highlights quite quickly?
Yep, so I can only speak of my firm, but I'm pretty certain, I hope it's kind of industry standards, we work with a RAG system, so a red and green, almost like a traffic light. So in the report, green tends to be, we're all good, no issues. Medium is something that we've notified, it's not something to be scared about or, you know, hold back drawdown, but it's just something that we need to continue to manage and make the funder aware that this could escalate and become a problem. Or then you've got red, which is, let's all run, we're not doing any drawdowns, and we need to make sure this problem is either mitigated, or how do we work around this issue.
And what kind of red problems do you find that come up that your advice to the lender is hold on from the drawdowns until we've resolved this?
Oh, cool. How long have we got? So one of a current issue that I had on a site a few months back was that they had been shut down because of health and safety reasons, which had been flagged. So we had raised it in the back. It was, again, little things like very messy site. And I know these are really silly things, and it is a construction site, so I'm not expecting it to be you can eat your food off the floor. But in some ways, it makes it a dangerous environment for people to work around.
Absolutely.
Ladders and things not being tied in properly or not being protected. Edge protection when they're taking it down to put up plasterboard and dry lining. You know, these are slip hazards. And we flagged these things 6-7 months ago. We always make the site manager aware on site. But then when we leave site, whether they action these points, that's, you know, that's another thing. And I think what happened in this scenario, we had made it the bank aware. The health and safety inspector came around and said, not compliant, shut down. And you've got to shut down for 2 weeks and make good.
That's a great example of why you have to go back to site more frequently. Mm-hmm. Because if you left the site for 3 months, then you can end up from a tidy site to a very dangerous site.
And God forbid someone hurts themselves or
and then the site gets shut down completely, and then the lender's in trouble. So absolutely.
And in that scenario, who sends down the health inspector? Is like if it's the lender's liable?
No, so there is a requirement. So under CDM regulations, depending on the size of the scheme, they should be having regular health and safety inspections.
Maybe that's another podcast, eh? Find one. and does anyone ever challenge a report?
Yes. Again, when I say challenge, normally it might be a scenario of where we may disagree with a drawdown application from the borrower. The good practice in terms of monitoring surveying should be that should already be negotiated and discussed and agreed with the borrower. What I think is incredibly unprofessional is the monitor surveyor to reduce down a drawdown application, send it to the lender, and then the lender gives them 50 grand less than what they're expecting. That's incredibly unprofessional and, again, not good for relationship purposes. So by definition, people challenging it, that would be, in that scenario, the borrower, but giving them an opportunity. If we go around and say, look, there's no windows on site, you've claimed for 100% of windows, absolutely not, go away, we're taking it out. But then if they say, well, here's a pro forma invoice or a deposit payment, then that's different. So we're giving them an opportunity to justify what they're doing. And it's not a case of we don't trust the borrowers or developers, but we are a risk protection mechanism for the bank. So that's an example where possibly it might be challenged. And then in terms of, we don't really get them challenged by the bank because ultimately they're appointing us to advise them. So I think where we've flagged, the only times where possibly we may get a challenge would be you've mentioned a delay on site. You know, the borrower is telling us that they're still going to come in on 12 months. You know, is this because the lender's always going to be looking at the facility term. Whereas if we say, well, no, actually, we based on progress to date or, you know, cash flow run rate, this can't be done. So I think that's where the lenders want to make sure if they've got to go back and have a possibly difficult conversation with the developer about increasing the facility and all the lovely fees and whatnot that come with it. That's where they might challenge to make sure that, you know, it's not us just being overly cautious. So that's an example where possibly banks or lenders might come back and say, are you happy with these dates?
And I guess moving on to question four, we sort of already touched on this, but question number four, can you predict when things are going wrong on site?
Good question. Again, there's a lot of things that we can't predict as surveyors and anyone in industry. And I think a prime example of that is dear old COVID. You know, no one could predict these things that happen on site and do have a huge impact. I would say there are signs that, you know, monitors, and this is where I think a lot of people got very nervous with drone technology and things like that. Is that going to replace the role of a surveyor? In my opinion, no, because a drone isn't going to be able to pick up on. For me, you can always see signs of distress because the supply chain and the labourers, for those of you who have been around a site, will never keep quiet. So if they've not been paid or if there's issues, they will be the first people that will be shouting. And I will always, if I go around the site, I will talk not just to the developer, but I will talk to the subcontractors because that's the first way you can find out if something's going wrong, because normally it's non-payment or, you know, whatnot, and the trades are very quick to shout about that. So that's always an early warning sign if there's been non-payments or delayed payments to supply chain, because the first thing will happen is they will suspend works or terminate works and walk off site, and in which case that's not good for the lender, not good for the borrower, not good for anyone on the site. The other thing is which I call, and it's normally on the initial appraisal, is the monitor sniff test, which is, for me, I think you can get a vibe from a lot of the developers. When you walk around that site and do the initial meeting with them, there's just a feeling that I always think that you lend to who you like, and then to who you want to be working on these deals with, because again, it's not just a transactional piece where you're lending a load of money and then off you go. You know, you are in bed on that deal, as is the monitor. So it's a relationship industry, and I think that's what you should be lending off. So it's looking at the borrower and, is this someone I can work with and I can deal with? Because it is a very, very close relationship, as much as people don't think it is. It is. You are, that facility could be 18 months, it could be 4 years, you know, depending on the scheme. So it is a long time to be working with someone. And I always, that initial sniff test of, do I trust this person? You know, would I, if it was my money, would I lend it to them? These are all questions that I think a lot of experienced monitors tend to ask as well, because I think it is important, and that does help our view, and when we're looking at strategy and risk for the bank and reporting back, saying, well, actually, we've got a bad vibe about this, we don't really trust what they've been giving us, and the information's weak. So, you know, approach with caution, Mr. Lender.
Yeah, absolutely. We take that view 100% ourselves. You know, when you're lending on a bridging loan, it can be very much asset-based lending. When you're lending on a development site, asset is just a part of it. I'm not even sure I'd call it 50% of part. Yeah. It's just a part of it. The other part, probably the bigger part, is the lender. Who are you lending to? And I really believe in that. And, you know, Katrina and I were involved in a recent round table conversation, and I pointed out to them that when times are really good, then it's just, you know, the borrower is just looking for finance. Mm-hmm. But when times are difficult, you actually have to find a good relationship in the lender. And that's something that, you know, from our perspective and from your perspective and hopefully from the borrowers as well, it's all about the relationship of explaining what's happening on site and when. And I've never seen a site that's gone 100% to plan. There's always been a hiccup and a hurdle along the way. And it's about how the team together, and that's not just the borrower's team, it's also the lender's team and the man in the middle, Blaine.
It's in everyone's interest, isn't it? It really is in everyone's interest for the scheme to work. And that's where sometimes I think, you know, we are an extension of the lender, where we are managing that relationship as well with your borrower, that it's not a case of you guys just lending money and you're looking to just make as much money as possible. I mean, yes, that is the ultimate goal, but it is a relationship thing. And when times get tough, which possibly, you know, let's see the landscape of the market for the next few years, that's when actually the lender is critical, because that relationship part, there might be pain and gain to be had on all sides here in terms of the market. And a lender that understands that, I think, is critical to the borrowers.
Before we wrap question four up, I just wanted to touch on, you mentioned the conflicts of interest between borrower and lender and yourself. Are there any others that people should be aware of, or is that kind of, you know, the main one?
Yeah, I think that would be the main one for me, and that's coming from the monitoring surveyor perspective, that really we shouldn't be engaged with your borrowers because there is a conflict of interest. And just to put it into context, this goes down to things like sharing the reports. And the reason why, it's not because we're precious of our reports and we love them that much that no one else can see them. There's a number of reasons why it really shouldn't be done, and it is in breach really of the appointment. Is, if you put it into context, where you've released the last drawdown report to the borrower, and in that report we said, we weren't happy with site conditions, we expect them to progress, we think there's a delay of 3 months in the project. The borrower's seen that, and again, it's back to the ego thing. We are managing a lot of egos in this industry, and we're managing relationships. Now, if there's possibly a weaker monitors around the site, the borrower could have that report to hand on the next site meeting physically and be quite intimidating, saying, I don't want you to put that in the report anymore, please take it out, Mr. Monitor. And you as the bank, you're almost kind of grenading the monitor, because you're putting them in very awkward position there, that again could really tarnish the relationship. And the other thing as well, which I think some lenders forget, is that if the borrower then has access to your report, God forbid, if they're looking for a refinance, you have given away your key to them being able to refinance that with another lender, because you've given them the report, which is solely for that lender.
Ah. Absolutely.
What about you, Ellie? Do you see any other conflicts of interest from a lender's perspective?
No, I would agree with Blaine that the main conflict is around that relationship. And the role of the monitoring surveyor is to be the eyes and ears on the ground. And if you're not going to use them as your eyes and ears, you might as well just go yourself and do it yourself.
Yeah, and have save the borrower the 15 months
and
of
and then have
payments.
The battle with the borrower yourself. This is, you know, it's a great way. That conflict is the opposite of that relationship, effectively. So they come hand in hand.
Well, question number five. How did you get into being a monitoring surveyor?
Yeah, good, very good question. So I got into the industry. So my father is a carpenter, and I used to help him out in my ripe 15-year-old teen days of just hog carrying on
site. Is
that
how you noticed dodgy bricklaying?
Absolutely, because it was probably all mine. So I used to help my dad on site and just, again, general labouring and hog carrying. And I actually wanted to be a carpenter, but my dad turned around to me at the age of 15 and said, no, absolutely not. He said, don't be that. He said, be the cool guy in the suit, be that one in the car that comes around. And it turned out that was the surveyor. So I went away and showed my age. I went to the library and got a book because there wasn't Google and things like that are now so accessible. And looked into the role of surveyor. Thought it sounded really good, part doctor, part detective on schemes. I thought that sounds really exciting. Went to university to do my surveying degree. Then moved into contracting QS. So that is actively building things, so working for the developers. So I was site-based. Then moved into the PQS side, which stands for professional QSing, working for the likes of Deloitte's and JLL, where, again, still acting for developers, but on the consultancy side. And then I got seconded into UBS Investment Bank, and I was their in-house monitor, and that's how actually I got exposed to monitoring, because I wasn't aware that there was such a function, because it's such a niche part of surveying, or QSing, as people like to call it. And I really liked that side of it. I loved the fact that we were advising the banks and we were that strategic level. So it is it's a lot higher level in terms of, we're not just bricks and mortar. There's so much more to it. We are looking at, you know, sales, you know, can we get out of this deal? We're looking at the loan, looking at the facility terms. And I found it incredibly engaging, but it wasn't something I was aware of even at university. It was pretty much, if you were a surveyor, you were project manager, QS, or a building surveyor. And they were the only three forms of surveying that I was aware of.
And do you need a qualification, I guess, to be any of those three you've just mentioned, and then a monitoring surveyor?
I think it's changed. In my day, in my day, it was pretty much a case of you had to go to university, get a degree, and then become chartered. But I don't think that is the case now. I think you can actually do it via experience route now. So you can actually go straight into trade. You could become an apprentice surveyor. And actually, in my opinion, I think people that have probably done that have probably got a lot more exposure to site. And certainly in terms of like a monitoring surveyor capacity, where it is, you are walking around them sites, you're trying to see any risk or any issues. And if you've always been a desktop surveyor, as I call it, which is more the consultancy side, then actually, if you don't know how to build something, how can you possibly advise a bank in terms of any issues of it?
Yeah, I think that's a great difference between a QS and an MS.
Yes.
Where the QS is going to be quite mathematical based and spreadsheets looking at procuring cost on site. Well, the monitoring surveyor has to understand how that site gets built and when things are done correctly and when things are done incorrectly. And a QS often won't understand that. Just like you said, they just don't have that experience of knowing how that works.
I guess also, could I or Ellie be a monitoring surveyor on your own site? How does that work between just you going, as a lender, do we have to hire a monitoring surveyor? Or in theory, could you go down, but you would because it's better?
I think it would be down to, the experience. And a lot of lenders, and I'm probably going to get told off for saying this, but a lot of lenders have started to consider the in-house capability of a monitor. I don't disagree with it, and I understand why they're considering, but I have a very strong view of this, rightly or wrongly, is it goes back to the same position of the independent. We are there to tell the lender things that not necessarily they want to hear, it's what they need to hear. Now, if I, say, started working for TAB, and Ellie came at top of me as my boss and said, nope, we don't want you to say that, don't say it, then actually you've kind of mitigated the whole point of that independence. So I can say, this scheme is crap, don't lend on it. You know, that is the position, and we're there to protect you, because I'm not making any more money or any less money by doing this. It is the role that we are there to undertake. And I think sometimes if you're payrolled, I think you lose that independence.
Is my view. Absolutely. And we take a view that it's probably project size for us. So if you've got something that's a smaller refurb, so we've got a borrower who's looking to refurbish a very large 3-bedroom flat, and the total cost of that refurbishment is £200,000. We could probably do that in-house without the need to bring in somebody external. But when you're looking at, let's say, someone developing 4 flats, costs go above £600-700 million pounds for that, then
I think it's horses for courses, isn't it? I agree with that. I don't think necessarily a monitor needs to be on every single scheme, but I think, again, it does depend on that scheme. If you see a scheme that's technically quite complex, and again, regardless of value, you know, it could be quite a highly complex scheme where you think actually it'd be nice to have that extra safety net, then, so that's my view. I don't necessarily advocate monitoring every single scheme, but I think it's
quite similar to a valuation. Yeah. Before we lend, we go out and get a valuation. Now, I can do my own research on the value of that property and take a view myself, but ultimately, that's the person who does it day in, day out, all day long, loves doing what they're doing, is excellent at what they do, and that's the value that Blaine and Pride can bring to Tab and other lenders.
And I guess just finally, what are the best bits or what are the bad bits? let's start with the bad bits because I'd like to end on the best bits.
Yeah, so the bad bits, which to be fair, is the role
there
I generally love my role. I skip out of bed. I generally don't ever wake up thinking I don't want to do this. I love what I do. I think the bad bits are when possibly it's not necessarily a deal going distressed, because as Ellie rightly pointed out, it's a risk industry, things go wrong. That is just the nature of the beast. Development is risky by its very nature. It's how we manage that and how we work together as a team to get over the line. I think it is when there's the fundamental breakdown in relationship between borrower and lender. And that's where it becomes very difficult, because when you lose that fundamental relationship, it is a different role we're playing then. We are kind of playing middleman.
Mediator.
And it's mediator. You know, that is what we, you know, in some cases, kind of psychiatrists and things like that, that we are there just to mentally support the deal. And whilst we're there in an independent capacity, which again, I do think is the value of that independence, that there are times where, you know, we have said to the lender, actually, you're not correct to do this. You should be doing this, you know, by the letter of the contract or, you know, whatever it might be. And then there's also the same scenario where, you know, the borrower is not conforming to what they're required to do. So that bit I don't like, but ultimately it's part of our job. Yeah. And that's something we do. The good bit is generally seeing successful deals, you know, the kind of textbook job. You know, we lend the money, no cost overruns, no program overruns, a proper textbook scheme. You know, in and out, 12 months, all sales gone, and it's good. And that does happen. Yeah. You know, we generally do see that. Not often, but there have been some real success stories. But I like working for lenders where I think that we're valued, that we're not just considered we have to have a monitoring surveyor. It's the ones that, you know, generally consider what we do, the value in what we do. And that's the bit I love about our role, that we're there to advise and protect the banks.
And where can lenders who are watching this find you?
Everywhere. We have our website, www.prideims.com, if you wish to see a bit more about what we do. But again, LinkedIn, you know, the normal platforms that we're there. And to be fair, if it's a lender that doesn't know me, I don't know if I want to work with you anyway.
Well, I guess on that note, thank you for joining us today. It's been
really
interesting.
Very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you'll have to send us that link to the project you're talking about, because I'd like to check that out. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I will see you next time for real estate lending, real estate law. We'll cut that bit out. See you next time. Thank you very much. Bye.